Well, it was a very personal expression today as, again, families of the serial killer's victims gathered on the steps of the state capitol to remind South Louisiana. Ann Pace released balloons at today's Justice for All rally in memory of her daughter, Murray Pace. May 31st will mark the one-year anniversary of Murray's brutal murder. And for the first time, the parents of the most recent victim of the serial killer, Carrie Lynn Yoder, attended the monthly rally. Dave Yoder says he drove 10 hours from Tampa to speak to this crowd.
It was important to keep the case before the public because you were trying to warn people there was a serial killer out there, and you also felt that there were people there who knew this person.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clementi, retired FBI profiler and former New York City prosecutor and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds. And joining me today via Skype is
Laura Richards, advocate, analyst, and author, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds and Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. And can I give a shout out?
Sure, go for it.
So we finally have an air date for Beyond Borders. It's the second season, and this is the show that stars Gary Sinise, and Jim Clementi's brother, Tim Clementi, is a writer-producer on it as well. So Beyond Borders is going to start airing on Wednesday, March 8th. It's going to be on right after original Criminal Minds, so I guess it starts at around 10 p.m. So please, please check it out. Set your DVRs. Even if you don't really want to watch the show, play that DVR while you're washing the dishes.
Of course you would want to watch the show.
Because the DVR, that counts. So I'm super excited. We go to all kinds of fabulous locations and track down serial killers on this show. We go to Florence. We go to Russia. So I'm so
London. You come to London?
We did not go to London.
Not yet, but I'm sure it'll happen. And here's the thing. They actually do some filming in all of those locations, actual on-site in every location that the show covers. So that's pretty amazing.
What was the date of that again, Lisa?
That's going to be Wednesday, March 8th.
Great.
Excellent.
And so today we're continuing our series on murder in the bayous. But there's been so much going on, so much has happened, and we really need to catch up. So, yeah. Laura, why don't you catch us up on what you're doing over on the other side of the pond?
Well, things have been pretty busy over here. The weather's not been great, but hey, that's London.
It's also L.A. You know, it's been, ever since you left, it's been raining here every day. I mean, every day. It rained again today.
I hope it's going to change.
We've had more rain in the last 2 months than we have in the last 5 years.
Well, I love it.
Yeah, it's good for the reservoirs. And they say that there's like 20 feet or more on the mountains of snow.
I've been thinking about you, Laura. Laura loves to ski. And we tried to go skiing, Laura, and we couldn't get out of L.A. because the roads were washed away. We couldn't even get to Mammoth.
Oh, my goodness. You know what? If it's rainy down here, then up in the mountains, it would be very snowy. And I've been watching. I really do love to watch the weather forecast, certainly in the ski season. And Mammoth's had an amazing amount of snow.
Yeah.
It's like 20 or 30 feet.
I know. It's crazy. And I know this is off topic, but Laura once told me, she's like, there's a big, huge storm coming into Colorado. And she's like jumping on a plane to go. And I'm like, I would never do that if there's a big, huge storm coming. I would not do that. But you are just a daredevil.
That's the best time to go. You get all the good powder if you're a powder hound.
Well, we certainly hope you enjoy it from our warm homes here in LA.
I'm a Bunny Slope girl myself. But anyway, okay, so tell us the important things that you're doing over there.
Well, at the moment, I'm preparing for a conference on March the 6th, which is with Professor Evan Stark. It's on coercive control in Suffolk, and there's some great speakers. Evan, myself, Dr. Lisa Aronson Fontes, as well as, and she's American, incidentally, as is Evan, and as well as Dr. Jane Monckton Smith. And there's going to be a fantastic production by certain Curtin Theatre, who do a brilliant production called Lady in Red, which is about coercive control. So there's still a few tickets left, some excellent speakers, and I'm hoping to catch up with Evan and hopefully record a pod with him. One of the very sad things I've been involved with has been some analysis of the Helen Bailey case, which was an author, a famous author over here, an incredibly sad case where she went missing. And actually her partner reported her missing 4 days later after the actual event. And the behavior was very concerning in that it was a whirlwind relationship. She had recently been bereaved. In fact, her husband of 22 years died in front of her, caught in a riptide. Very, very sad. And she wrote a book about it, When Bad Things Happen in Good Bikinis, about her being on the shoreline watching him die and how traumatic that was. And that was her first adult book because she was a children's author. So she pretty much put her soul and her heart online. And then she went onto a chat forum, a chat line for those who are bereaved. And she started talking to someone called Ian Stewart. And the relationship is, moves along very quickly. He persuades her to move out of London, which had been her home for 20 odd years, and go to Hertfordshire into Royston, quite a small village. So she was pretty isolated and certainly vulnerable in some sense. And he persuades her and corrals her into making him the executor of her will, having power of attorney, and proposes to her. He, in fact, his first wife, Jim, died very suddenly in unexpected circumstances, but it was never looked at as a criminal investigation.
Of course not. And he did it again.
Well, it certainly looks that way. I mean, the day that she was missing, he was trying to move money out of her account into the joint account, a sum of £4,000, and he was trying to sell one of her properties. So the other thing that they found out, because actually it took a number of months to find the body. The body had actually been put in the cesspit in the house, and it hadn't been searched properly. It was in a garage, and her dog was also found in the same place, her dachshund dog called Boris, and they went everywhere together. And when they did the post-mortem, they found out that she had a sleeping drug in her system and that she'd been drugged for a number of months. So, it really does look like there was coercive control. She was certainly calling her mother and saying, I feel like I'm losing my mind. I'm falling asleep. I don't know what's happening to me.
She was being gaslit.
I was just going to say gaslit. Yeah.
Yeah. And doesn't that really narrow the suspect pool tremendously, Laura? Because, I mean, somebody had to have access to her over months. And who is that person?
Who is that person? Well, the last person who sees her and reports her missing is the partner. And certainly by all accounts, his behavior, Jim, the post-offense behavior is fascinating in that, it takes him 4 days. He, on the call he makes to the police, he can't remember anything to her eye color, her date of birth. There's certain information, and he obfuscates and talks about all these other things. And he says that she left a note, which she never did. He then goes away on holiday. They had a holiday plan. He goes off for the 2 weeks on their joint holiday, which is very peculiar. And then he comes back, and the police are actually, they knock on his door in the morning, and he kept saying, did you look in the garage? And that's where the cesspit was. And that's exactly where they looked, and they found her body. So there was all this very peculiar, post-offense behavior from him. And it's been in court recently that the jury just came back and he got 34 years. He was sentenced to 34 years. And now the police have one of my recommendations, certainly from that analysis. And it was in a show called Murdered by My Fiancé, which aired on Thursday. It was a ITN Channel 5 production, and a number of other experts were talking on it. But I was certainly talking about the power and control dynamic of him trying to control every element and aspect of her life down to her finances. And it wasn't talked about as being a domestic violence murder. But I was pleased to hear that they were re-examining the first wife and the circumstances in which she died in. So it certainly looks to be very interesting, but it's a very, very sad case. And, I felt from getting to know her through all her videos and blogs, she was extremely intelligent, articulate, funny, authentic and honest. And he exploited all of those things. And she's definitely, more than a victim. So I felt it important to give her a voice and have tweeted about it. And I'll be talking about it at the conference on March 6th, that particular case.
And I just want to thank you, Laura, for helping me on my last episode of Criminal Minds called A Good Husband, because we explored the whole concept of coercive control and how people don't even understand when they're in it that they're actually being controlled and how deadly it can turn if that person tries to break away from the controlling partner.
Absolutely. And I think, Jim, you know, it's exactly what happened in this case, that Helen wouldn't ever have described herself as a victim. You know, we know about 52% of victims don't see themselves as being that, even when every aspect of their life is being micromanaged. Mm-hmm. And that's what I saw with Helen's case. And I strongly suspect that on the day that he killed her, that she was talking about separating from him and at least taking some time out to clear her head of things. And of course, we know separation or someone trying to leave is, you know, a time when risk increases. And I know you played that out in the episode, and, you know, it was a real pleasure to help you with that storyline.
Well, thank you. I think it was a very important Criminal Minds episode because we did explore something that really needs to be litigated. I mean, we really need to have a law change here so that people can actually legally get out of relationships like that without risking their lives.
Yeah, the early intervention part's important. And funnily enough, two of the speakers coming to the conference on March the 6th, Evan Stark, he was one of the advisors when I was campaigning for law change over here. And Lisa, Dr. Lisa Aronson-Fontes also has written a book, as well as Evan. But they talk a lot about how America, you know, the states, there are some leading lights working over there, such as them, but still hasn't criminalized coercive control. And it really does. You know, perpetrators will not use physical or sexual violence if they can control people using other tactics like coercion. I mean, like Ian Stewart did, was drugging Helen so she felt like she was losing her mind and going slowly mad. And whether it was his intention that it meant he made her change her life insurance and will as well, so that if she died before they married, that everything would go to him. So he was clearly eroding, you know, her sense of self and exploiting her vulnerability. Not that you would think she was vulnerable if you listened to her talk. I mean, if you Googled her, but he was exploiting every aspect of her life.
Oh, so tragic.
Well, I wanted to bring this up to you guys, and this kind of seems like the perfect time. There is this actress, Pauly Perrette. I don't know if you watch NCIS.
Sure. She's actually she may be still the most favorite character on TV.
Really?
I know she was listed as number one.
Wow.
Yeah.
So if you haven't watched the show, I don't watch the show, but she's definitely, I definitely know who she is. She's got like the goth look. She's got long dark hair. She wears the ponytails and bangs. Right. Anyway, she came out last night in a 48-hour special talking for the first time about her stalker. And I'm just so grateful to her for coming forward to talk about it. It's a two-night special on 48 Hours. You can, by the time our podcast airs, it will have already aired, but you can go to the 48 Hours website. It's a CBS show and watch it. And because I know Polly's agent, I want to reach out to her and see if she'd like to come on the podcast and talk about anything she wants to. But
absolutely. I mean, I did see on Twitter quite a few people did tweet our Real Crime Profile Twitter handle, as well as my Laura Richards, saying that the show was going to air. And I think she's calling similarly as I am for law change in the US. And I think the anchor was as well. I didn't get to see the show, but I heard very good things about it. And, you know, I would love an opportunity to talk more with her and support her.
Well,
it's really,
Laura,
terrifying and lonely when you're being stalked, and it's so isolating. So the more awareness we can raise, and, you know, getting her on the pod will be fantastic.
Yeah, and I know that in our prior conversations, you said you've been looking for someone who can be a spokesperson, who can sort of be the torch holder to lead that challenge to the legislature to change the law. And maybe Paulina will be that person. That'll be great.
Absolutely. I mean, I think certainly in California, the state of California, one of the real problems Jim sees, as I see from talking to lots of, you know, people who are being stalked at the moment there, is that, you know, within the legislation, it certainly hasn't been touched for 24 years. And you have to, it has to be deemed to be a credible threat, and it has to be a threat to kill, and it has to be deemed to be credible. Wow. So, of course, stalking by its very insidious nature, you know, it implies a threat when someone, it's a long-term pattern of persistent behavior that's intrusive and it's unwanted, and it implies a threat. But, you know, in California, for example, there has to be a threat made explicitly, and someone, you know, LAPD have to deem it to be a credible threat. And that's where it always falls down.
So, yeah, and that's too late in the game, as we know from experience. I mean, the direct threat is the control and the lack of ability to get access and all that. And if many times, if they can't get access, if they don't get what they want, they just lash out.
Yeah, and that's the challenge. And, you know, with LAPD or other professionals, how do they make those assessments? As you know, Jim, you know, it's a very specialist area, and we're asking people who aren't trained in this area in a very niche subject to make rudimentary assessments of whether someone means to cause serious harm. And of course, you know, we know the statistic that one in two domestic stalkers, if they make a threat, will act on it. And one in 10 of other stalkers, if they make a threat, will act on it. But we can't expect all of law enforcement to be, you know, experts in this specialist area. So I think that's a real challenge with the legislation and with protecting victims and giving them the right advice as well.
So we're going to turn to the killing bios in a moment. But before we do, this seems like a good time for me to share a letter that we got from a listener that I've been wanting to share for a long time, and for our listeners to understand that, you know, Laura's work and her influence goes far beyond anything that we know about. Things are happening that are incredible. So I'm going to try to conceal this writer's identity and the identity of her daughter. But here it goes. So this listener, her daughter was brutally murdered by her domestic partner, and his sentencing was recently. And thanks to the excellent work done by the police department and the DA, he got a life sentence. And almost every week this listener listened to us, she would jot down notes, a phrase or a statistic or anything else that she felt she could use during her victim impact statement to ensure the verdict was what he deserved. And she says it worked, and she can't thank you enough, Laura. And when the hearing was over, the judge asked that all of the people who were there in support of her daughter remain behind. And the judge asked all of them to go out and keep working to end domestic violence. And her question to Laura is, where does she start? Because she had no luck with any of the local elected officials. In fact, one even told her that they can't possibly have stricter domestic violence laws because women are too hysterical and will make untrue accusations. Ugh. She was stunned, and she told this person that her daughter was not hysterical. She was dead. So this listener began to follow what was happening in the UK with stricter stalking laws and the success with Dash. And she's hoping that there's some way to do that in the US. So she signed off in her daughter's name. And I mean, are you kidding?
That's outrageous.
She's in a very, very small state. And I'm sure that this is not a big topic of discussion within law enforcement in that state, unfortunately. So,
well, she can actually be a very educational witness, and she can, I would suggest that she writes everything down, that she sends letters to her local representatives, her state representatives, and to her congressmen and senators. She still has a voice, and she will be heard, I believe, if she talks about what happened to her daughter, and if she's willing to step up and actually testify in front of Congress, she could actually make a change.
Mm-hmm. She can. And, you know, I remember you forwarding the email to me, Lisa, and I did send her some more information. I know that her and her husband were meeting with some other councillors and senators, I think. And
exactly.
You know, she certainly has a voice, and it just shows how outdated views are, you know, and how much more we need to educate and raise awareness of the issues. You know, this isn't about hysterical women. This is about dangerous and serious and psychologically injurious, but also physically, you know, this can be lethal violence. So they do need to take it seriously. And I'm happy to work with any families, you know, who are bereaved. And, you know, as you know, Lisa, we've been inundated with so many emails of people asking for assistance mm-hmm. that it's very difficult to keep on top of so many serious cases and people who really do need to get the right advice and help. But I want to say, you know, on a positive note, I had an email from a law enforcement officer from not too far from where you are currently. Her name was Shannon. I won't say anything more about where she's from, but she had emailed to say what a difference that Real Crime Profile had made to her practice, to her everyday law enforcement work, and that because of our podcast and the information we've given out on coercive control and stalking, the cases that we've covered and the dash, that she instantly recognized a case that a colleague was dealing with, that she said it was on the seventh attempt, you know, of this woman trying to leave, that that there had been an escalation, and she identified the coercive control and they managed to get the victim to safety.
Wow.
And she said, I mean, really amazing. She said she and her colleagues just felt, you know, so rewarded that they'd been able to get a, you know, a successful outcome, in inverted commas, that the victim felt happy, satisfied with the outcome, you know, as did they. And she said that never would have happened if she hadn't have listened to Real Crime Profile. And she said, you know, more of my colleagues really do need to listen to the topics of discussion. And it's similar to what was said to me in Stormont in Northern Ireland with the young officer who actually said, oh, Real Crime Profile, I listen to it all the time. You've changed my practice. When I interact with victims, I ask different questions and I use the dash. And, you know, it's great to hear the impact that we're having on the front line with the guys and girls who are out there, who are the lifelines, who are going to make the difference to keeping people safe. So, you know, I think that we're a great team and we all give something slightly different. And it's just fantastic and so rewarding for me when I read these emails. You know, set amongst the ones where people are in chaotic and devastating and terrifying situations as well. So you never know when you're going to be a lifeline, but I think Real Crime Profile really, really is one to many.
That is great. I mean, that gives me chills to know that we're actually being effective. And if one person writes in, there's probably many more that haven't written in, but we will encourage everybody who listens to please, if you do know somebody who is in a situation like that, if you find yourself in a situation like that, please use that dash risk assessment. Please call for help. There are resources out there, and get in touch with us and we'll do whatever we can to help you.
And there's a separate stalking checklist as well, just to say, because I know quite a few people have said they've looked at the dash, but they couldn't see the questions, the screening questions on stalking. And there are 11 questions for stalking. And there's also a separate 11 questions for so-called honor-based abuse as well. And I know quite a few people on Twitter have asked us to cover some of the so-called honor killings cases, like Benaz Mahmoud and the learning. And at some stage, you know, at the moment we have so many cases lining up, but at some stage we will get into some of those cases. But it is a good resource, the dash, and of course Paladin in the UK as well, and there's great hotlines in America for domestic violence. So please do, you know, look out for those, and we reference them at the end of each podcast.
Well, thanks you guys for catching up on what is going on outside the podcast. And so up next we are going to continue our discussion of the Killing Bayous.
Pam loved life. Every day, she couldn't wait to do all the things that she wanted to do. Oh, she was fun. She was exuberant. She was enthused. She was intelligent.
So we're going to get back to murders in the Bayou, and we're talking about the killings in the Baton Rouge, Louisiana area. Do you want to introduce our next victim?
Well, when we last left off, we left off with Diane Alexander, who had been somebody who survived DL's attack, and she's going to become very important in the next victim's case. But the next victim is Pam Kinnamore, and she was killed in Baton Rouge. Laura, do you want to say more about her?
Yeah, so this was 2002, wasn't it? On July the 12th, 2002, she disappeared from her home in Briarwood Estates in Baton Rouge. She was 44 years of age. She was a business owner and a wife. And I believe her body was discovered 4 days later under the Whiskey Bay Bridge, which stretches over the, I'm not sure how that's pronounced, the Atchafalaya Swamp, just west of Baton Rouge. And she had been raped and her throat had been cut several times to the point that, again, she was almost decapitated. She was a white female, dark brown hair, beaming smile, high pronounced cheekbones, attractive. And it's believed, her body having been found 4 days later after she's reported missing, that a trophy may well have been taken from her body, which is a small silver toe ring that was taken. And I think you know quite a bit about her, what her mother started campaigning for and sort of brought pressure to bear on the police to investigate her
right.
disappearance and her murder.
Right. So first I want to just track back a little bit and say that Pam was married to, her husband was wheelchair bound, and her mother tells a great story about how when he rolled down the aisle and he actually stood up, you know, for the wedding vows and then rolled her back down the aisle and she was on his lap. So, That's very touching. Very touching.
But her mother became her main advocate, right? And she really pushed things forward and became the squeaky wheel, basically.
Oh, absolutely.
Fortunately for all these other victims.
Yeah, I mean, she really did her best to keep the media attention. You know, she would organize all the other victims' families and they would go on the steps of the Capitol and have balloons and signs and just keep the clock ticking on how many weeks it's been since the last murder. And, you know, she actually was able to talk to call upon the governor and demand that he do something. And I think she really did make a huge difference in how the case, you know, went forward. They finally put a profiler on. I don't know if you know her, Dr. Mary Ellen O'Toole. Like, she came on the case to, why are you smiling?
No, of course I know her.
Okay, yeah, sorry. I don't know how big the club is. I don't know.
We worked together for, you know, over a decade. So,
well, there
yes,
you go. Okay, yeah. Well, but it occurs to me, I don't know if you guys feel this way, but, you know, Pam Kinnamore's mom was not afraid to talk to police. You know, she didn't have the kind of relationship with them that maybe some people in a poorer community might have had, like in the other victim pool we've talked about, where maybe their experiences with the police were not positive and they weren't trusted. You know, they didn't trust the police. So it just strikes me that's a different, you know, it puts the other community at a disadvantage because they're not going to get the attention of the governor.
Well, they certainly didn't get the attention of the governor, and they barely got the attention of law enforcement in the beginning. And, you know, that whole idea of throwaway victims is just horrible. And I think it speaks to the broader issues of what our justice system is really driven by. And the more powerful people get a different form of justice, and more complicated investigations are done with them or for them. I'm not taking anything away from the victims in this case.
Right,
what
right.
I'm saying
Very
is
important.
This is how it should be. It shouldn't be up to the victims' families to draw the attention of the public and the politicians. It should be the same for everybody.
Right.
Every single victim deserves to be treated like a human being. And when their life is lost or taken away from them by crime, they deserve the same amount of push from the justice system.
Right. And in Pam's case, you know, her family was able to offer, you know, $75,000 reward. But, you know, if you're from a poor family, you can't do that. And that's right. not going to get you the same amount of attention, the same amount of people searching for your loved one. So it's, you know, it's very sad.
But this is victim number six. And, you know, in this area, we talked about it in our last pod, that these are relatively low risk victims being targeted in a high risk way. And, you know, this is a rare type of crime. But we know in this period, 1991 to 2001, 53 women were murdered in Baton Rouge. And I still feel you know, very strongly about the fact that stalking and domestic violence and these other offences that he was committing, and women were going to the police and reporting him for peeping and stalking and domestic violence, and they weren't taking it seriously. So I think this family, yes, they had money, they were able to advocate for themselves, which not many people can. But I think, you know, they had to work really hard to do that, to get attention paid, you know, yeah. with women being decapitated. I mean, we talked about it before, Jim, but this, you know, type of brutality is actually quite rare. And warning bells, you know, should have been ringing long before Pamela's case.
Right. This is outrageous behavior. This is not something that somebody just thought about once and, you know, committed this outrageous, bizarre, extreme crime and wasn't ever going to do it again. This should have really set off, like you said, all the alarm bells, and it should have created an immediate response by law enforcement to have, and we'll go into them in more detail, but to have multiple women who live so close by be attacked and killed and disappear, and to have multiple women, their bodies deposited very near to each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, What do you need?
Yeah.
It's proximity. Well, you need a sign saying that this is the work of one person, obviously, for this particular police department, because, you know, everything points to the fact that they have got a serial killer on their hands, from the victimology, from the behavior, from the brutality. It's this, you know, the really serious brutality, the hatred and the power and control that's being played out on these women. And of course, August 2002, they do start the task force. But again, for me, it's a long time coming. And, you know, what we're hearing about, even with the cases we're going through now, we know they're just tip of the iceberg, because no one starts out brutally attacking women and raping them in this way and committing these kind of perfect crimes, in inverted commas. And I say perfect because it took a long time to link them, DNA link them, and for the task force to form.
Right, one little detail about Pam's murder is that a beige telephone cord was found near her body, and it turns out that was the same cord that was taken from Diane Alexander's home. So even, you know, before the DNA of the semen samples from both of those crimes, I mean, there was like literally a direct cord connecting these two women.
Can I just say, well, that tells you just about the lack of priority. You know, we talked about resources before, but it tells you that this type of case is not prioritized when the forensics aren't, the crime scene, you know, the evidence collection doesn't take place. And we're going to talk about, you know, the other cases too, but it happened in Eugenie Boisfontaine's case where, you know, samples were not processed. And we know rape kits aren't being processed still in the US. So, you know, this really frustrates me. I just think it's unbelievable and mind-blowing that they're not even processing the most, you know, in these heinous and brutal crimes, they're not even processing the crime scenes and prioritizing it.
I wanted to ask you about the multitasking skills of this kind of stalking. I mean, is he stalking several women at the same time? In your experience, do killers like this stalk at the same time? Because there's just sort of like an overlap, it seems, of these victims, or does he go one at a time?
Well, I mean, and Laura, you can certainly weigh in, but to me, he's casting a net in certain areas, and I think that's why you're having overlap in terms of the victim choice. I think that he obviously was in a neighborhood. He obviously was looking for potential victims, but there's some impulsive indicators in these crimes. In other words, that he hasn't specifically planned out that particular crime in detail in advance, but because there's disorganization evident, he uses weapons of opportunity. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, but he seems like he knows when the husbands are away. He absolutely knows when she's alone, Pamela's alone, taking a bath.
He likes to watch, you know, and with stalkers, predatory stalkers, they get gratification, the power and control of watching. And he would be watching for a long time. This is somebody who's been peeping from the age of 11. So there's the kind of the watching part. There's the enjoyment of that. And we know other victims reported him watching them. And then you've got, you know, he's gathering intelligence, he's gathering information. He has a victim preferential type. And some of it, I would say absolutely, you know, we're seeing him opportunistically at times and impulsively acting on his need-driven behavior, because he's not going in with particular weapons and it's not all planned out. He goes in with a confidence approach, sometimes a blitz approach. But he's spending a lot of time prowling around, watching people, stalking women, and women in the area were reporting that, and there were sightings of him. So this is absolutely predatory behavior. And his partners were also reporting abuse within the home. And, you know, his wife said the only time she got respite herself, and what we know from victims who are abused, you know, some of them offend the offenders inside the home, and some of them do go outside the home. And it was when he was out, you know, stalking and abusing other women, that she had some respite. So, and we do know that many stalkers are serial, and they do, where one victim might report a hiatus, it's because they're busy stalking someone else at that time too.
Right. And, you know, when you look at the actual facts of the case, there is some evidence of organized behavior and disorganized behavior. The disorganized parts, as Laura said, he used weapons of opportunity. He didn't actually bring the items necessary to commit the crime with him or have a plan of attack necessarily, but he did most likely use some sort of ruse or con to get the initial access. And then from there, it depended on how the victim responded, whether he was going to continue that ruse or whether he was going to turn it into a blitz attack. And so the pre-attack surveillance is certainly a stalking aspect, and it's certainly an organized and fantasy-driven aspect of these crimes. But not being prepared for what you were going to do once you got there, kind of doing it in the moment, may have been part of the thrill for him, may have been what got him excited. Like, I'm going to do it. It's risky. It's dangerous. I'm on my way to work. I'm on my way home from here, or whatever it is. I'm going to do it now. I'm going to take this opportunity. I'm going to take my chances. And I think the fact that people have reported sightings of him and sort of minor infractions like peeping and trespass, that these are the times where he tried and he didn't know that the husband was going to be home, yeah, or that somebody was alert and so forth. So he has failed many times, and he perfected his art, his MO along the way.
And that's what perpetrators do. They learn as well. They learn their tradecraft. You know, I know lots of serial offenders, you know, it might look like a robbery or an attempt robbery, but they're compliance checking, you know, to see whether a victim will be compliant or not. And they may not, you know, if someone's wheelchair bound, then they may not have seen them out and about. So, you know, we've had cases where serial rapists have gone into the wrong house because they didn't know that there was a male living there. This is in an elderly lady rape series. And, you know, because the husband was wheelchair bound and house bound. And so he's gone back out again. So they will at times through their surveillance and, you know, get things wrong. But someone like DL, we know, is quick-witted enough and charming enough and charismatic enough to talk his way out of situations too. So this is someone who's very confident, not criminally sophisticated, but has the ability to be able to get himself out of situations when difficulties arise. And you've got to bear in mind, no one's knocking down his door for a long time. People are not knocking down his door, and we need to talk about that in particular.
Yeah, despite the fact that he had numerous interactions with the police and arrests and all these nuisance crimes and lead up crimes. And it's outrageous that he was free to go and he was free to do whatever the hell he wanted. Mm. And all these women had to suffer as a result of that.
And what do we know about offenders, Jim, when they get away with it?
Emboldens them.
Well, I was just going to say that we're about to move on to the next victim, who's Trinesha Danae Colomb. And she's 4 victims just in 2002.
Yeah.
I mean, that's...
It's certainly a serial killer. It's not something that you should be disregarding. It's something that... I mean, it took them till then to actually start a task force. Well, we're already on victim 7 now, right? 7 victims. What about the first 6? I mean,
but does that speak to his confidence that he's just like, he's on, I mean, on a roll, basically.
Well, it could.
He's getting away with it over and over and over.
It speaks to his confidence. It speaks to his sexual drive.
His need-driven behavior. And we're talking about the DNA-linked ones. But as we know, Jim, you know, you don't just start out committing, you know, an abduction and, you know, a murder and disposing of someone and the body never being found. You know, there's going to be lots of things before that, right?
Right. So that shows an accomplished, criminally sophisticated offender, especially one who is so boldly doing this. Many of these attacks are in daytime. Many of these attacks are right down the street, a couple of doors away from other attacks that he did. I mean, you would think that he would want to stay away from that area because how hot it should be, but clearly it wasn't hot. Mm-hmm. Clearly the police were not addressing that issue at all, or in a way that made any meaningful difference. Maybe they had no resources.
I think this next victim, you know, and you pointing out the timeline, there may well be things in between, but this is November, isn't it, of 2002. And, you know, the thing that strikes me about this case in particular, well, one, we know the victimology, Trenisha Colom, would you pronounce that? Colom is, you know, she disappears. She's 23 years of age, but she disappears from beside her mother's grave.
From beside her mother's grave. I mean,
out in the open.
Right, exactly. I don't know if this is the first victim who was snatched out in the open, but what is that? Does that tell you anything else about the killer?
He, exactly what we predicted. He's going to be emboldened. He's going to feel invulnerable, and he's going to know that he got away with everything. He's got very little to risk because he's already gotten away with all these other crimes. If they catch him for them, he's going away forever. So why not do more?
And Trenisha was
just horrific in its nature, you know, that she's there grieving for her mother. So, of course, you know, vulnerable in many senses. Her mother had died 7 months earlier and, you know, she has disappeared from that gravesite. So, again, it tells us he's trawling around, he's watching and preying on vulnerable people. This is on November the 21st, 2002. I believe she was, you know, trying to come to terms, obviously, with the loss of her mother, but was also planning to join the Marine Corps, which tells us probably something about physicality in some ways, or, you know, in terms of, you know, good physical condition. But she was certainly, again, a very attractive woman who stood out.
Yeah, right now. I mean, she has a beautiful smile. She is this. What I have is she was the first Black victim and the first victim just outside of Baton Rouge to be linked to DL. I don't know if that's significant, although, well, you know, we know Diane Alexander was also African-American.
Right. But the fact is that this tells us that since he picked her up from a place that he couldn't have known in advance that she was going to be there or what time or how long she was going to be there. That this goes, again, towards the impulsive nature of this. When he sees what he wants, he takes it. And he objectifies these women. He does not at all have any feeling of empathy for them, any feeling at all for them as human beings. And he just wants them. And we know when he got into Diana Alexander's house that one of the things he whispered to her while he was violently raping her after he attacked her was that he was watching her. He'd been watching her. And this kind of offender has a real sense of entitlement. Mm. I mean, they feel and they justify in their own minds that this is something they want. This is something they're going to take. And thank God in the case of Diana Alexander that her son came home and he was chased off. Otherwise, I'm sure that she would have been killed.
Also had a chance to speak and brought practically the entire courtroom to tears as they spoke about their love for Murray and how her death affected them.
I hope they'll remember the pictures they saw, remember the descriptions we gave, and take that with them to deliberate, because if they do, I do not see how they could possibly return a verdict other than death.
So the next victim that was DNA linked to DL is Carrie Lynn Yoder. Laura, you want to talk about?
Sure. So you know, she was 26 years of age. This was in March 2003, where Carrie had just returned from Mardi Gras, from a trip to New Orleans for Mardi Gras, when she disappeared from her home on Dodson Avenue in Baton Rouge. I think it was the 3rd of March, you said. And her body was found floating under the Whiskey Bay Bridge on March the 13th. So Whiskey Bay Bridge, if we think again about, we just discussed Pamela. And Pamela, their bodies were found quite close together. So again, should have been a clue. But she had also been raped and beaten, but she had been strangled. So again, difference in terms of, you know, what had happened in terms of this was a strangulation. I'm not sure. I didn't find any information about how she was strangled, whether it was manual or telephone cord, as we've seen in a couple of them.
Right. And it just goes again to show you the disorganized nature of this offender, that he is not following a specific pattern. And although there's indicators that he must have done pre-attack surveillance, that he must have stalked some of them, that he must have been in the same neighborhood multiple times, that he must have deposited the bodies in similar locations multiple times. Although all that is present, there's an indication that he likes variety. I mean, that he likes to do different things, and maybe he was doing that as a forensically sophisticated move to try to throw off the authorities, to try to make it look like it wasn't one offender. But I think you and I very clearly can see through that. And in fact, there are a lot of other victims that we'll talk about in our next podcast that we can also link based on that those behaviors alone.
Right. And the behaviors are key. And just to say a little bit more about her, she was originally from Tampa and was working on her master's degree at LSU. So again, you've got another link back to the university, which is obviously one of his hunting grounds and where he can pick up a victim pool. And she was actually, her dream was to save the Louisiana wetlands, but she was a white female, long curly brown hair, a very big smile and pronounced cheekbones. Again, you know, an attractive female, someone who stood out. And someone to me who, you know, I think there's a theme that I kind of feel with the victimology, that these seem to be unobtainable women to him in many respects. Perhaps that unobtainableness, you know, again, when we see the amount of time that he spends and enjoying watching them, but the level of brutality and the violence that's meted out on them, you know, almost decapitating, you know, it really does, to me, point to sort of this real hatred and power and control, destroying something that he can't have. It's just so brutal and violent.
Yeah, and I think that rage is all born out of complete disrespect and disregard for women, and I believe firmly that would have definitely shown its ugly head in his relationships, in his real life, in his interactions at work and at home.
Absolutely. And, you know, with the profile, that's one of the first things I would be saying, that whoever this is, they would be known for domestic abuse, you know, coercive control, physical and or maybe sexual violence and or stalking. And, you know, he would be on a police database, probably, you know, in the locality. And that's a way you can use police databases and intelligence to track down serial perpetrators and serial killers such as this. But so often people just do not understand those links, that if you're prepared to be this violent in a external setting, you know, you may well be having significant relationships with others, and the quality of those relationships will be abusive, and vice versa. If you're violent and abusive in the home, I always say, you know, based on that premise, what are you prepared to do to someone that you don't care about? And we have to make these links. It's so important.
Yeah, you mentioned the use of databases, and in an upcoming episode, we're going to talk about a great article. It's an article from Bloomberg Businessweek, which we'd like our listeners to read before our next episode. And it's called Serial Killers Should Fear This Algorithm. And it's about Thomas Hargrove, who is building software to actually suss out where serial killers are operating. Really interesting article.
Yeah, I want to give a shout out. Actually, that article came to my attention from a couple of our listeners. So,
awesome.
So nice job, you guys. Thank you so much for
that. Thank you. And we'll share it with everybody, and then we'll talk about it. We'll do a podcast about it.
So one of the things to mention is we keep talking about DASH and how it's impacted on people's practice. Well, I'm actually running a number of sessions for the Domestic Abuse, Stalking and Harassment and Honor-Based Violence Risk Model. And we cover coercive control and the legislation, as well as stalking and forced marriage. So there's a session, a masterclass on March the 9th, which will run all day. And that's in London and it's university accredited. And there's a Train the Trainer event that will be on March the 16th, which will be a full day as well. And you can be accredited to be a university accredited trainer in the UK. And then there's some refresher training as well on March the 23rd for the masterclass as well as the 30th. So if you've been trained and you are accredited to use DASH, then you'll probably need to be updated. Training really only lasts for 6 months and I'm running those sessions. So you can email Jenny at laurarichards.co.uk if you're interested in attending.
And you should think about when you come back here, setting up a DASH training here, because I'm sure the people and the police officers and the professionals around domestic violence would love that.
It's a good idea. And I have had a few people email asking for training. So it's something I'm now trying to turn my mind's eye to, and people are trying to book dates, etc. So I'm looking forward to that. And I'm happy to, I have wheels and we'll travel. I'll take my texture app with me and all the others use Lyft wherever I go. And, you know, it's very easy for people to get around. I love traveling as well. So I'm more than happy to train anyone anywhere on domestic abuse, coercive control, stalking, and how to identify the warning signs and what to do about it.
That's great.
And I wanted to just say, by popular demand, we do have a hoodie designed. Yes,
yay,
you can get your very own Real Crime Profile hoodie soon. We're using a different vendor this time, and I'll be posting the link on Facebook so you can get yourself a nice snuggly hoodie. And just remember that a portion of the proceeds do go to charities that are close to our hearts, like Paladin. And CASA, which is the court-appointed special advocates for children going through the foster care system, and
Male Survivor, which is an international organization that helps men and boys who are victimized sexually.
So we want to see you buying those hoodies and posting pictures of yourself on Facebook and Twitter. We'd really love to see you in those.
And I know, Lisa, Megan's going to be very excited about that. This is one of our very dedicated listeners who tweets a lot and has been desperate to get a Real Crime Profile hoodie. So she's going to be really excited. And I can't wait to get one as well, although I'm hoping it's going to be sunny when I eventually hit California that I won't need a hoodie. But thank you for doing that. And I look forward to seeing it.
Well, you could always use a hoodie on the beaches at night here. It always gets a little cool. Yeah.
Only if it's got Real Crime Profile on it. I know you're wearing a Criminal Minds one today, Jim.
I am, because I'm loyal to Criminal Minds as well. But there's plenty of room for crime. Real Crime Profile and Criminal Minds. And Criminal Minds Beyond Borders.
That's right. All right, guys, signing off for Real Crime Profile.
So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357 or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.
If you're a regular listener to the show, you know we have great brands like Blue Apron, Audible, and Casper advertising with us, and they keep coming back because our listeners really respond to them, which we're really thankful for. Well, if you happen to own a business or manage the advertising buy for one, then you should consider advertising on Real Crime Profile. Podcast advertising is on the rise, and it's one of the most effective ways of reaching consumers on the go today. So please go to Wondery.com/advertisers. Again, it's Wondery.com/advertisers. And get in touch with us. Thanks.